Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The coronavirus has raised a lot of questions about the future of work and the workplace. For now, though, the drudgery of work continues, and that includes meetings. No doubt you've had to log on to a video conference during this new world of working from home. Comedian Alexis Gay has done a pretty good job of capturing how meetings are sounding these days.
Hey, can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Can everybody hear me? Are we waiting on anyone? Can everyone see my screen?
Oh! There we go. Welcome to my kitchen.
Look at your little cat.
His wife's also working from home, so he's just hopping into their closet.
Oh, sorry. I think you're muted.
Although you might get to go to these meetings in your sweatpants, that doesn't make them any more enjoyable. Even before our work lives were upended, you were probably questioning the value of these get-togethers. You might have walked away from one thinking, this could have been an email. Wouldn't it be nice if meetings were less frequent, shorter, had the right people in them? Well, yes, of course, that would help. But the real problem with meetings is bad meetings. If only there was a science to them that would make them better. Well, it turns out there is. And a UNC Charlotte professor wrote the book on it. Dr. Stephen Rogelberg is the Chancellor's Professor and Professor of Management at the Belk College of Business and the author of The Surprising Science of Meetings, How You Can Lead Your Team to Peak Performance. When the book was published in January 2019, Dr. Rogelberg joined us at our Spirit Square studio. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Dr. John Kello has been a member of Davidson College's psychology department since 1974, but also conducts research and does applied work in industrial organization psychology. He and Dr. Rogelberg have been known to share information on meetings. In fact, they collaborated on many papers, including The Science and Fiction of Meetings. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you, Mike.
So for the purposes of this discussion, for the purposes of your book, The Surprising Science of Meetings, How You Can Lead Your Team to Peak Performance, what constitutes a meeting? How many people must be gathered therein?
Well, two would do it.
Really?
So, yeah. Two is basically considered a meeting.
But when you talk about meetings being dull and boring and is it ever going to end? And I'm sitting there doodling on my pad or my tablet because I've tuned out the meeting leader. That's got to be bigger than two meetings, than two people, right?
Oh, the levels of dysfunction increase as meeting size increases. Interestingly, though, that often people will prefer a very large meeting.
So they can doodle and
ride. So they can multitask, right? So the larger it is, the more you're able to kind of blend into the background and do other things.
Well, multitasking used to be people just scratching on their little, on their legal pads, like they're taking notes, but they're really doing tic-tac-toe or something like that. But now we have smartphones and tablets, and people are on them throughout a lot of meetings. Don't meeting leaders find this disconcerting? Do they see that as people actually listening and taking down notes? Or do they see that as people diverting their attention to other more important things like, oh, I don't know, the New York Times crossword puzzle?
So first, do meeting leaders even notice?
Sometimes
meeting leaders are more about featuring their own voice and not necessarily being attentive to others. In fact, some of our research shows that one person leaves a meeting always feeling really good about it, and that's the leader of the meeting. They tend to think everything went really well.
Clueless.
It's a blind spot. It's a blind spot. But, you know, multitasking is pretty intriguing because while it definitively will derail a meeting, you know, when we interview employees, they basically say they have no choice. Their workload is just too much. They're being invited to too many meetings that are dysfunctional. And the only way they can keep moving is to multitask.
So I got two guys at the table here who study meetings, and I know that according to Dr. Rogelberg's book, Dr. Kello, that people are often surprised that there are, in fact, individuals who study meetings. And I take it you're one of those people that does that because you've written papers on it and you're a psychology professor. You also specialize in high-performance organization models and team-based work redesign. I'm not sure what any of that is, but do they involve meetings or at least finding ways to make meetings more effective?
They definitely do involve meetings. One of the things that the research has shown is that the impact of a meeting in the workplace extends well beyond the confines of the meeting itself. And individuals establish perceptions about their organization, about their leadership, about their level of satisfaction and engagement in the organization, not just in the meeting. So one of the critical elements of a true high-performance organization is our meetings make a positive difference. Our meetings add value, whether we're talking about a two-person meeting or the more familiar generic staff meeting, the regularly scheduled staff meeting. In a high-performance organization, those opportunities are capitalized upon. And a lot of organizations, they're not, as the research has clearly shown.
People may be shrugging this off as being not important, even if they loathe meetings. And most people that I've talked to loathe them. And I'm not sure whether they loathe them because they've been to a lot of bad meetings or they just don't like the whole idea of they got work to do, let's get on with it. But this is really important, not only for organizations, but actually for economies of scale, because there are, I didn't know this. I love shocking statistics. Mm-hmm. And I discovered yesterday, thanks to doing research for this, that there are 55 million meetings every single day.
In the U.S.
In the United States. My God. And that means that most people in those 55 million meetings detest what's going on. Is that true or is that wrong?
Oh, employee frustration is through the roof. Meetings are one of the largest costs for organizations when you think of it from a payroll perspective,
right?
Time and salaries. So this is an incredible investment organizations are making. And meeting time truly matters. Not only does it matter to productivity, frustration, employee engagement, but you also even have concepts around meeting recovery syndrome, that when you have a bad meeting, you just don't leave it at the door. It stays with you, and you often will ruminate, or worse, co-ruminate, as you all kind of make sense of this bad experience. So the bottom line is meetings definitely matter, but organizations, for whatever reason, have just accepted bad meetings as a way of life.
I've been to those meetings where you ruminate, and you get together as in small groups, huddling, whispering, and usually negative things about what you just heard in that meeting. Is it mostly because... the meetings are wrong in some way, they have the wrong people in them, there's no call to action, it didn't stick to any set agenda, that the person conducting the meeting didn't know what they were doing, or is it because we as employees don't like the information that's just been transmitted? It's either going to make us work harder or work toward ends with which we do not agree.
I think it all comes down to the meeting leader. The meeting leader, to the extent that she or he has a steward of others' time mindset, will dictate so much of the value of meetings. When you embrace this notion, you're a steward of other times, well, the meetings are going to be relevant, they're going to be lean, they're going to be conducted in an honest way that truly promotes inclusion and voice. Hmm. And this is where organizational democracy can take place. And this is where employees can actually shape their experience. But when a leader does not have that steward mindset, these things don't happen. And without that mindset, the meeting leader makes the meeting about themselves, right? And that's where the dysfunction can start to really take place, as opposed to facilitating an experience of meaning.
In one of the publications that the two of you worked together on, Dr. Kello, the Science and Fiction of Meetings, you say that ineffective meetings are harmful
yes,
to organizations. And the more time employees spend in bad meetings, the greater the job dissatisfaction and the more likely employees are to leave the company. Do you think people who run organizations know this?
I don't think they are fully aware. And I think the research that Stephen and I have been involved in, along with a number of other colleagues, indicates pretty strongly that the impact of meetings, especially the negative impact of a dysfunctional meeting, is really profound. And as I said earlier, extends beyond the confines of the meeting itself. But back to Stephen's point, I think most people in organizations accept that we meet on Monday morning from 9 to 10, and whether we have an objective and an agenda or not, we do that. And there's very little training per se for leaders, managers in organizations, in terms of avoiding the dysfunctions and running an effective meeting. Hmm. So Shorter answer, I don't think many people in the organization will realize the impact of meetings and the negative impact of a dysfunctional meeting.
But surely there are business consultants who come in and tell managers these things, aren't there?
So business consultants will teach basic meetings 101.
Okay.
But it's actually not very effective. It's often tactic-based. Hey, have an agenda. But actually, our research shows that having an agenda in of itself doesn't do anything for a meeting. It's what's on that agenda, how that agenda is facilitated. So there's so much more nuance than just teaching people tactics.
Are meetings, I mean, why did meetings start in the first place? Obviously, before we had electronic communications that instantaneously can communicate to large groups of people, from one person to 150,000 people at once or more, we needed a meeting sometimes. Has that time passed?
Not at all. And the technology really only expands the number of meeting opportunities that we have. It doesn't reduce the need for FaceTime meetings. There's very good research around
but
that.
Why? I mean, what is the primary function of most meetings?
There's a variety of functions. At the very least, coordinating activities across individuals who share a common objective.
Isn't there an app for that?
It's your brain and your colleagues. No, the FaceTime meetings are not, as far as I know, decreasing in frequency at all. In fact, there's an argument that the more teched up we become, the more need there is for high personal touch.
Because Forbes.com calls meetings the original collaborative productivity tool, but they say that they rarely deliver on that promise. Meetings have been going on since the beginning of time, and they rarely deliver on that promise. We know this now because of people like you. So is anybody taking action on this?
So you said earlier that you like interesting stats. Well, let me share another one.
I like shocking stats.
Well, this is actually pretty shocking.
We can get you there.
Okay. So I've had the good fortune of doing a number of presentations mm-hmm. around the surprising science of meetings. Some of these have been presentations at groups such as SHRM, which is a Society of Human Resources Management. And in all these presentations, I do these industry groups, and most of these folks are from Fortune 500 companies. Mm-hmm. I always ask a question. I say, okay, raise your hands if anyone in this room has on their employee engagement survey any content around meetings. What do you think? How many people raised their hands?
Zero.
Zero. I have yet to find an organization that actually assesses how they are doing with meetings. Now, when you think about that, this is an incredible statistic, right? You have in people spending 15, 20, 30 plus hours in meetings, mm-hmm. and yet there's no assessment of that experience. There's no idea, there's no metrics, no dashboard that's designed to see whether there's actually a return on investment.
Can you measure that? I mean, you guys are experts. Can you, metrics you could put in
Absolutely.
Place?
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
What kind of metrics would they be? How would you measure that? How would you know it was an effective or an ineffective meeting?
I mean, there's a number of ways. From asking people their opinions. People are pretty self-aware. And if you ask people their opinions of particular meetings or their meetings in general, they're actually pretty terrific at voicing what they see are the strengths and the problem areas. So that's kind of the whole philosophy of surveying employees and employee engagement in general, that voice matters.
Getting back to this Forbes comment, and I'll have to wait till after the break to get an answer for this, but the Forbes called these the original collaborative productivity tool, and most of the meetings that I have been in have been conducted from the top down, except are there any questions at the end of the meeting? We'll come back and talk about collaboration in meetings in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Everyone, now would be a good time to freshen up because I'd like everyone to meet in the conference room in 5 minutes, and I suggest that you bring a snack because we may be in there for a while.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about meetings and why we have so many of them. 55 million meetings that American workers collectively attend each day, at least in the days before the coronavirus. Dr. Stephen Rogelberg is with the Belk College of Business at UNC Charlotte and the author of The Surprising Science of Meetings, How You Can Lead Your Team to Peak Performance, which was published in January 2019. The Washington Post called it one of the top leadership books of 2019, and he joined us in our Spirit Square studio with his collaborator, Dr. John Kello, professor of psychology at Davidson College.
Getting back to this Forbes.com comment calling meetings the original collaborative productivity tool. The key there is collaboration, it seems to me, the key word in that sentence. But aren't most meetings top-down affairs? Are people conducting these meetings really looking for collaboration in the meeting?
You've hit upon the big problem. Meetings have so much potential, right? A world without meetings is highly problematic. Because if we don't have meetings, then we're discounting employee voice and inclusion and participation in the work environment. But so many leaders just don't have the skills. As John mentioned earlier, really meaningful training doesn't seem to be happening.
Is this a holdover from the 50s when everything really was top down and you did what you were told, you were given your marching orders and you wore your gray suit and your white shirt and your dark tie and you did what was expected of you? Whereas today, people want input. They want to be part of the process.
Agreed. If you look at the typical meeting that we think of when we talk about meetings in general, the staff meeting, those are generally boss-led. Those are generally top-down meetings. But the research that Stephen and his team have focused on indicates very strongly that high participation is one of the markers of an effective, positive meeting. So one of the things that we teach when we have the opportunity to work with business organizations is shared leadership, rotating leadership, moving the manager out of the meeting leader role, and developing those skills in others so that we can do more of a high engagement, high participation process and get away from the pure top-down approach.
I mean, there are a lot of reasons to have meetings, and many meetings are necessary to communicate key information to everybody at once and not have it, not send it in an email that you may or may not read all of, so you might miss some of the key points. So you sit in the meeting and you hear all this, but how much of a reason to hold a meeting is team building and to get buy-in to whatever it is you're holding the meeting about?
I see team building as an important byproduct of a good meeting, not as a primary purpose of a meeting. Okay. When a meeting has purpose, has focus, has objective, is well led, involves participants in terms of high interaction, some sense of collaborative work, team building, cohesion begins to develop within the group.
How much of a part of a meeting or how much of the goal should be to energize people so that when they leave that meeting, they're pumped up and ready to do whatever it is the task at hand is supposed to be?
A lot. The enthusiasm of the leader and other key participants in the meeting makes a tremendous difference.
How often?
So there's an emotional contagion effect, and Stephen, you can address that better than I. There's an emotional contagion effect, so that if a meeting is energized and enthusiastic, it does tend to spread throughout the team.
I mean, being energized is often a byproduct of just having voice and being listened to. So it doesn't have to be a fake or planned experience. There's just something very energizing when you get a group of people together and you have a very real, meaningful conversation where there's conflict that's actually resolved in a constructive way. When you think about organizations investing in diversity, well, if you have a diverse group of individuals, and I don't just mean surface diversity, but all kinds of diversity, well, ultimately, to tap into that diversity, you need for your meetings to be environments where there's genuine inclusion, that voices feel safe to emerge, and that ideas can clash. And that's energizing in of itself.
What happens if the clashing ideas go against whatever the leader intends for that meeting to accomplish?
When you're a good steward of others' time, it doesn't mean that you won't assert your own opinions, if indeed that's what's needed at that moment.
But don't you have to be a pretty secure leader to allow that to happen in your meeting?
Of course.
Challenging you. You're the boss.
Mike, it's part of what we teach when we have the opportunity to work with people in terms of building and managing effective meetings, is we encourage leaders to establish ground rules of shared leadership and active participation. And we talk a lot about psychological safety, which essentially boils down to, am I free to speak up if I have a counterpoint?
But people say things that they don't mean. I mean, I have experience with this,
pardon,
my friend. No, I have experience with I once worked for a company that will go on name. That brought in a consultant, and they told us, you can tell this consultant anything you want to. It will not come back to management. He's going to synthesize what you say so that we can manage this organization better. Every single word that was said got back to management. Mm-hmm. It was quoted back to us verbatim.
That is obviously entirely unethical on the part of a consultant. It's breaching one of the core principles when you assure confidentiality. And it also sends a very strong message throughout the organization that I shouldn't believe things I'm told.
So I guess the question in these meetings where you want things to be collaborative and you are, quote-unquote, encouraging conflict, clashes of ideas, so that maybe an idea that hadn't been thought of that goes against the grain might be a better idea than what we've been doing all along, how can you, as the person delivering that clashing message, be sure that you're safe in doing that? Because you might leave the meeting saying, I got it off my chest. I'm energized. But then the next day, you get your pink slip because you're not a team player.
You know, unfortunately, individual participants, members of meetings, are very much beholden to the leader. So you won't know, and you might have retribution, mm-hmm. and all kinds of negative things can happen. It's always going to come back to that meeting leader having credibility and established a genuine culture around these ideas.
So in meetings where people do leave energized and unthreatened, and life goes on and is better because of the meeting having happened, how often does that happen? How often do people leave a meeting feeling energized?
I would say more than you think. We actually have found an interesting pattern of results that when you ask people about their meeting experiences, what they usually voice is tremendous discontent. And that's basically because it's socially unacceptable to whistle down your hallway saying, I love meetings. Meetings are fantastic. But when we ask people in private their opinions, they're actually more favorable. And frankly, this shouldn't surprise us. There would not be so many meetings if they weren't accomplishing something.
Well, there, when you hold a focus group on a product, if you're doing product research, you always ask people to write down what their opinions are, and then you conduct these meetings because the leaders emerge in focus groups, and suddenly everybody conforms their opinion to theirs. But if you look at what they wrote on that paper privately, it can sometimes be different. There's a group dynamic. So if the zeitgeist says that meetings are bad, they're boring, we got to go to these meetings all the time, that's going to be what people think about meetings. But privately, you're saying, not necessarily so.
No, there's a difference. The public versus private opinion of these experiences is different.
Okay.
What you describe, Mike, is a variation of what's called brainwriting, which is an excellent brainstorming tool that allows individuals to basically establish their own opinion and not be overly swayed by the comments of others. And again, in Stephen's book, there's some sections that deal pretty directly with some how-tos of the brainwriting technique.
Well, and I mean, interesting, your example is actually a really interesting one, because those leaders who kind of embrace that steward mindset, and by the way, you can predict leader derailment based on how effective people are in their meeting. So if a leader does not embrace being an effective facilitator of a meeting experience, their likelihood of derailing is much higher.
Okay.
But going back to your example of writing ideas down, well, that's something that can be done in meetings, right? So if you're leading a meeting and you need to brainstorm, well, the research actually shows that if you do that technique that you outlined, you're going to get more and better ideas. So why not do that? It creates more inclusion and more voice and better outcomes.
I wanted to share an email that's come in while we're talking. David on Facebook, I'm on my way to a meeting. Facepalm emoji. Bill in Davidson writes, I'm a retired teacher. I was constantly astonished at the dreadful weekly faculty meetings. There was no end time, often lasted 2 hours after an eight-hour day. In my time, I had exactly two principals who provided an agenda and ran effective, quick meetings. Marilyn on Facebook, another teacher. Thank goodness that I no longer have to attend these meetings. One principal refused to allow us to grade papers. We were expected to sit transfixed on his every word because he loved the sound of his own voice. Richard emails, when I worked at the bank, people would regularly ask, how many people work at the bank? I would reply, about half. The rest go to meetings. Now, we said that there are 55 million meetings every single day in this country, and here's what they cost. You brought this up, Dr. Kello. $1.4 trillion.
Direct cost.
Yes. That's 8.2% of the U.S.'s 2014 GDP. $1.4 trillion, and the return on that investment, how would you describe it?
It varies a lot. There are individuals who, whether they've had training or not, are skillful at being a leader of a meeting. They hit all the bases. They set the tone for the meeting and for their group. And in that case, their meetings might be rated by their people as 80% effective. There are other individuals whose meetings are rated by their participants as 0% effective. Wow. On average, we get like a one-third to one-half kind of figure, averaging across all of the research, all of the data of different meeting types. I, in particular, have done a lot with safety meetings, and I generally find in the industrial setting, safety meetings are very common. About a third of them are perceived as highly effective, and about a third of them are perceived as a total waste of time. So I think a third to a half based on customer feedback.
I would agree. I've done a number of these meeting audits for organizations where we try to build that dashboard and figure out the return on these things, and it's consistent. I would say that most organizations are around that 50% of time in meetings being considered a good use of time.
Because Samuel on Twitter has shared this with us. I have to turn off the show now so I can go to a daily mandatory meeting that accomplishes nothing that can't be done by email. I'm choking on the irony. So let's talk about that. Do managers have meetings because that's the way it's always been done?
Yes.
We're going to do it because we've always had a weekly staff meeting or a daily meeting.
Yes. Next question. Yes.
Are they calling more of these meetings than they used to, or are the number of meetings about the same as they've always been? And has there been attendance creep? In other words, are more people invited to these meetings than used to be?
Definitely, yes. Stephen. Yes. Unfortunately,
why?
Yes.
Yes. You've said yes to all these questions. So why? why are we having meetings when just because we've always had them? Why are more people having to come to them?
Part of it is because technology makes it just so easy to invite everyone under the sun to attend, right? So we can hold people's calendars captive and stick them into a meeting. Now, our intentions might not be bad.
Yeah.
We might be doing it because we just want to be highly inclusive and not to alienate anyone. But technology has definitely led to an explosion of additional meetings.
You blame Google for this. I think it's in your book. And I guess you could lay the blame on pocket calendars, but it's not so much the same. Because with Google and with Microsoft Outlook and with IBM in the old days creating software that allowed you, as you say, to commandeer someone else's calendar, or you send out an email that's nothing more than a thing that I don't even know what you call it, but it's an invite, and you have to click accept, decline, or something else. You can't decline a meeting from the boss, so you have to say accept, and it goes on your calendar. Made it easy for them to make you come to that meeting because it's on your calendar now.
Right.
And these calendars are broken down into hour-long increments.
Yes.
What happens if the meeting only needs to be 10 minutes? And you don't want to have it at 1 o'clock. Maybe it's convenient for everybody to do it at 1:26.
Yeah. I mean, there's defaults, and then there's, you know, the programming required to be more thoughtful in your decisions. And the fact is, being thoughtful in your approach of how long the meeting should be and when it should be is something that is not the default. So we often reflect, why are most meetings 1 hour? Because that's the default setting. And at the same time, we know about Parkinson's Law. And Parkinson's Law is this idea that work expands to fill whatever time has been allotted to it. So magically, a meeting scheduled for an hour takes an hour. Well, that's very problematic when people just start throwing 1 hour meetings. So one of the things that I talk about in the book is trying to be more thoughtful and deliberate in determining how much time a meeting should have, and then actually dial it back a little bit. Because humans respond better, respond well from a performance perspective when there's a little bit of pressure. So we can use this to our advantage.
So just as you just said, the Parkinson's Law says that work expands to fill the time allotted for it to be done. If suddenly the time was shorter,
exactly,
you get more done because you race through it, or are you as effective?
So you need to be thoughtful on the time allotments. So it's not taking a rich agenda and squeezing it down to 10 minutes, but it's actually thinking. If I could just get meeting leaders to think for 5 minutes before a meeting, good things are going to happen. But there's so many meeting habits. Meetings have become this incredible habitual behavior. You can find meeting leaders who recycle the agendas meeting after meeting after meeting. And all these habits are just leading to this lack of thought. So if I can get a meeting leader to stop and say, okay, what really needs to be accomplished as opposed to what can be done via email. And then after they think about what really needs to be accomplished, say, okay, well, this should probably take this many minutes and don't succumb to the defaults. Maybe add a little pressure. That could be the sweet spot.
One or both of you write about people who hold these meetings, who conduct these meetings, need to sit down and think about the agenda.
Absolutely.
Who's going to be there and what might happen in the meeting so that they walk into the room completely prepared for whatever may happen that may deviate from the agenda and also be prepared to put it back on track. Correct?
One of the critical moving parts of an effective meeting is pre-planning. So the owner, the leader, who always sets the tone, even if he or she rotates out the responsibility for running that meeting, that individual alone or with others on the team basically does some thinking beforehand. What's our objective? What's our purpose? Do we need this meeting?
Right.
And if the answer is no, the best thing you can do for everyone is to cancel the meeting.
That's Dr. John Kello, who is a professor of psychology at Davidson College. Dr. Steven Rogelberg is the Chancellor's Professor of Management at the Belk College of Business at UNC Charlotte, the author of The Surprising Science of Meetings Together. They've written The Science and Fiction of Meetings, and we have more science, fiction, and fact to return to in a moment in Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Hey, y'all, this is Tommy Tomlinson. On this week's episode of Southbound, we talked to Rachel Lanz, whose new book called In the Waves explores a deep southern mystery, the death of the crew of the Confederate submarine H.L. Hunley. You can find this and every episode of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org.
Support for Southbound comes from Southeast Radiation Oncology Group.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Steven Rogelberg is our guest, Chancellor's Professor and Professor of Management at UNC Charlotte's Belk College of Business and author of The Surprising Science of Meetings. He was in our Spirit Square studio along with John Kello, Professor of Psychology at Davidson College.
We have an email from Katie who says, what you are talking about, this is a few minutes ago when we were talking about collaboration in meetings and maybe clashing with ideas. What you were talking about is exactly the perspective I brought with me when I moved from an uptown bank to a Union County family-owned company. When I encouraged collaboration and brought enthusiasm to meetings with an outside consultant present, the consultant loved my enthusiasm, but the owner, senior leader, responded with, well, she hasn't been here very long. I have experienced exactly what your guests are talking about. Lots of resistance. Many leaders want meetings to remain top down. And that may be part of why you say, Dr. Rogelberg, in your book, that there is extensive evidence that meetings are draining the life out of individuals, teams, and organizations. Is that part of the problem?
That's definitely a big problem.
That's the worst thing I've ever heard.
Oh, it gets worse, Mike.
I mean, when you report that when Verizon surveyed over 1,000 heavy meeting goers, they evaluated their meetings as being extremely, very, or at least somewhat productive. There seems to be a contradiction here. On the one hand, you say they're draining the life out of organizations, but Verizon has found something else to be true. That's because they don't have to call themselves and wait on hold.
So, yeah, you know, it's I guess it depends on who you ask. I think that employee frustration with meetings is at an all-time high. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because people are busier than ever. Maybe it's because there's a greater ability to get on people's calendars, as we talked about. Right. Maybe it's because of the fact that leaders don't have the training to do this right. Maybe it's because of the fact that leaders keep perpetuating the same dysfunction that they themselves experienced. So there's lots of reasons why this problem is not truly being solved.
But the sunshine, you say, is peeking through the clouds because mm-hmm. people are actually now interested in understanding this phenomenon and doing something about it?
I think so.
More and more.
The most surprising thing to me has been the early media reaction. I was shocked. Washington Post named it the number one leadership book for 2019. My reaction was, oh my gosh, how could that be? And then it happened with Business Insider. They also named it one of the top 14 leadership books for 2019. I was really interested in the book. I'm like, I better see what I wrote. But the fact is like that communicates that maybe society and organizations are finally ready to think about meetings in a much more holistic fashion, to recognize that there's actually an opportunity here, right? Because you have this high base rate activity, you have lots of frustration. Well, that's a perfect combination for opportunity. We can make positive changes. And if we even make 20% of our meetings 20% better, the incremental cascading effects are tremendous.
Self-examination is not necessarily very easy, but if you are a person who regularly conducts meetings and you're hearing this conversation and you would genuinely like your meetings to be effective and not boring and not draining the life out of your employees, what do you look for in yourself? How do you self-identify? Well, I shouldn't do that anymore because this just, that's not good.
As scientists and practitioners, and that's the framework within which we work. Okay. We intend to do rigorous science and make it accessible to people outside academia. When we're doing that, in our translations of science into practice, in the book, in the articles that we've written together and published in business sources rather than in academic journals, we're making the core ideas available, accessible to people who can use them. So I think there's more and more. We have done that more and more, and again, a lot of the best research has come out of the UNCC Org Science Group that I have the privilege of working with collaboratively, but we get that information out. We're doing our best when we make our science practical.
But I mean, if I'm somebody who conducts a meeting, how do I know what's good and bad that I'm doing in that meeting?
By the book.
I really agree. That is a great suggestion.
The book is a distillation of 15 years of hard science made accessible to people who can use it.
What's that book called? One thing you say is that one of the biggest complaints about meetings is that they are too long. Is there an ideal length for a meeting to be?
It depends, back to the primary issue of what's the objective, what's the purpose, what outcome are we after? If we're doing a strategic planning meeting looking at the next 5 years, we probably need several hours, half a day, maybe more. If we're talking about a routine, again, the generic staff meeting where we update, we review the past week, we talk about what's coming up, we touch down quickly and move on, we probably don't even need the full hour that it typically takes. And if we're talking about other kinds of meetings, like a shift change meeting mm-hmm. or a safety meeting, they can be much briefer than that.
Well, I think, Dr. Rogelberg, you say that all meetings should be 5 to 10% shorter than your initial estimate of what they'll take.
Yeah. I mean,
How did you arrive at that?
That would not be, that's my opinion, okay. Based on extrapolating from some of the other psychological research about adding a little pressure. Really, the point I'm trying to make, and this comes from a chapter where I say, make your meetings 48 minutes. I actually don't believe your meeting should be 48 minutes, but I want people to be deliberate. I want people to be thoughtful on how much time to spend. And then because meetings tend to drift and not have focus, I like the idea of trying to dial it back 5 to 10 minutes to kind of create some focus, right? Because that's what we want. We want a focused experience that truly honors people's time because people are so busy.
It's interesting you should pick 48 minutes because that is the length of an hour-long television show. They pad it out with commercials. So can you do that in meetings? Can you put commercials? the most effective meetings, you say, are meetings that occur when leaders see themselves as stewards of everyone else's valuable time. How many leaders see themselves in that light, do you think?
Some. The best.
Yeah.
But not all. Not by a long shot. And on the back to the issue of psychological safety, one of the things that meeting leaders can do in order to continue to improve their meetings is to get feedback from participants
on an
ongoing basis.
Why don't they know this intuitively? Because leaders of meetings generally are people who are executives, and the higher up the ladder you go, the more meetings you have to attend that you're not conducting necessarily, but you're in them all day long.
Yes.
So why don't they suddenly, why don't they intuit that? You know, it would be better if I were more cognizant of the people in this meeting's time.
It goes back to that blind spot argument we had earlier, that when it comes to perceiving ourselves effectively, we tend not to do that very well. One of the best predictors of someone's meeting satisfaction is talking. So if someone talks a lot, they think it was a good experience. So do I think this show is going well right now? Yes, because I get to talk a lot. But does your audience think so? Well, their experience is fundamentally different. So the fact that our talk is predictive of our affective reaction to that experience is highly problematic. So if you have a leader who's dominating, loving hearing the sound of their voice, they're going to come out of there feeling that this was a good use of time and therefore not change behaviors, not seek feedback, just basically keep repeating what they've been doing.
Mike, there's a related point. In addition to the amount of airtime that the leader takes and therefore must be a great meeting because I'm talking so much, there's a phenomenon that the research has revealed called surface acting. And what we find is that if I'm in a meeting with my boss or my boss's boss, and the boss is going on, I'm not going to be showing non-verbally or otherwise that this is kind of a crappy meeting. I'm going to look really interested and engaged. Mm-hmm. So I'm putting on the best face, but my actual feeling about the meeting may be very different than what I'm projecting verbally or non-verbally.
So plan ahead. Make the meetings shorter than you think you need to make them so that you'll force yourself to get more crammed into the time allotted and let people go early. Is there an ideal number of topics that you should cover in any given meeting, particularly if it's the weekly or monthly staff meeting? Is there an ideal number of topics?
There's not an ideal number, but you want to order your agenda so that the most important topics are discussed first. So many agendas start with fluff, news and notes, and they basically save the most important, vexing, challenging issue to the end, when you're basically running out of time, or you might not have time.
Yeah, a lot of meetings begin, and I'm trying to find it in my notes here, with updates on where we are on certain projects. You say put that at the end.
So when I look at a perfect meeting cadence, I see that the first 5 minutes, so first of all, it's starting the meeting well, starting the meeting with energy, the leader recognizing that they're actually a host. And a host welcomes people, they make introductions, they thank people for coming, right? Because ultimately a meeting is kind of serving as that interruption. So the first thing is you start as a host, welcoming. Maybe a first few minutes is taking care of some quick announcements, really to allow for meeting transitions, right? So a lot of times people's previous meetings run late, so this allows them to still get to the meeting on time. But then after 5 minutes, hit the top issue. Hit the issue that will truly draw people in. Hit the top issue that matters. Answer the critical question so that all those individuals from the get-go say to themselves, my gosh, I'm glad that I'm here because this is an important topic. And then wrestle with that. And at that point, you know, if you use up all the time, well, the only thing that's being cut are things that are less important than that key issue.
One thing you recommend is, where possible, dispense with presentations in meetings and allow instead for a silent reading period for people to read what essentially would have been your presentation so that they can what? Discuss it after, take it in on their own time in their own way and not be inundated with PowerPoint slides and charts? What's the deal here?
So silence is a powerful technique that leaders can leverage. Part of it is some of the stuff that we talked about earlier, is that you can get better brainstorming when people write down ideas and then there's a discussion. When you write down ideas, for example, you don't filter based on other people's reactions. Now, what you refer to is something that has been popularized by Amazon. So the standard...
Jeff Bezos does it this way, right?
What's that?
Jeff Bezos does it this way.
So Amazon, this is their typical process that instead of fighting against the human flow, the flow that people don't prepare for meetings, will use the meeting to create an even playing field of preparation.
But couldn't silent reading be done? You send somebody, you send your participants, 20 people, the email with the presentation. Read it. So why have a meeting?
It could, but you mentioned earlier the challenge of using email or the intranet by way of update. The issue being a lot of people don't read it. So then it comes back to the leader to establish an expectation that when we post something on SharePoint, everyone's going to review it prior to the meeting. That's more difficult to leverage than having people do it during the meeting. That's my experience.
But people read at different speeds.
Right.
I mean, if you see somebody moving their lips, they're reading pretty slow. Other people can speed read like Evelyn Wood. So what do you? How much time do you allow for that? How long should this be? Should it be a page? Should it be five pages that people sit there in the meeting and read silently? What should it be?
Let me say, too, that is a technique for a typical, again, generic staff meeting that often makes a great deal of sense. It's around problem identification, problem solving. It wouldn't be a part of every meeting.
Okay.
And I've written a lot about safety meetings, which, again, are ever-present in the industrial world. You asked the question earlier, what's the right number of items to deal with? The answer from the research on safety meetings is 3 to 5. One is not enough, and 25 is too many.
Okay. So Richard Branson, who's the brains behind Virgin Atlantic and other companies, is said to insist that all meeting attendees stand or walk, which would, I guess, keep your meetings pretty short because people don't want to stand for too long, and they certainly don't want to walk anymore. But we see examples of these walking meetings in all of Aaron Sorkin's shows, be it Network or The West Wing. Makes for great TV, great entertainment, but does a walk and talk and a walk and listen meeting really work?
It can. So there's been a theme of this conversation is a leader making deliberate choices. So depending on what you're trying to accomplish and the size of the group, right? So walking meetings only work with a maximum of 4 people, right? If you really want to have a conversation, right, you can't have a herd of people, but you can have a small group of people. And if you don't require a presentation or extensive note-taking, then you don't need that. But there's so many meetings that can be done via walking, right? You can have a meeting where you're checking in with someone, getting updates, offering support, figuring out kind of what's working well, what's not working so well. So there's things that you can do, but you have to be planful with a walking meeting. They have to be shorter. You have to recognize that different people in the workplace wear different types of shoes. So you need to tell people in advance that you're having a walking meeting. You need to make sure that your walking meeting is actually in a loop so you return back to where you started. So there's planful behaviors that you can do.
And what about these standing meetings? Does that tend to make things shorter, more productive? Are people more attentive?
I would not generically recommend that for a staff meeting.
Okay.
But for, as an example, in industrial settings, there are shift change meetings.
Right.
And they are standing and or walking meetings by their very nature. They are 5-minute information exchanges.
When you take people, when you put people in a meeting, you're taking them away from work. And there are people who really are task oriented. Their goal in the day is to get it done. And when they're in a meeting, they can't get it done. And it drives them crazy. What about those people, those people who are negatively affected because all they can think about in that meeting is, I've got this to do and I've got that to do and it all has to get done by 5 o'clock?
research going back more than a decade now shows that individuals who are highly conscientious in terms of one of their personality facets, who are achievement strivers, they're the most positively impacted by a meeting that achieves something mm-hmm. and the most negatively affected by a meeting that they see as a waste of time.
That's John Kello, professor of psychology at Davidson College and a collaborator of Steven Rogelberg's. He's Chancellor's professor and professor of management at UNC Charlotte's Belk College of Business and the author of The Surprising Science of Meetings, How You Can Lead Your Team to Peak Performance. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.